You open the fridge. There's nothing there. So what's it gonna be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-through burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein. No artificial flavors or colors. No chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
Browns
why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
And I found that especially distance running, but in track and field, the more you put into it, the more passionate you are and the more aggressive you are as an athlete, the more you will get out of it. It's a guarantee that you probably could look at me and know that I was never going to play D1 basketball. But I kind of willed myself into being a D1 track guy.
And our guest this week is Mike Glavin. He is the director of men's and women's cross country and track and field at St. Joseph's University. He has been coaching there for more than three decades. And Mike, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. 36. This is the 36th year. That's where I am right now.
Not bad at all.
Yeah.
So as we're recording this mid-February, what is life like for you? What's the focus right now?
From early January until May, it's absolutely crazy because there are meets almost every single weekend. So you're going through the practice routine with, we have about 95 men and women combined on the program. And so you're trying to split those into event groups for daily practice and then get them all ready to travel. Last weekend, we left on Friday and came back on Saturday. So a 2-day overnight with, we don't take all of them, but we wound up with 65 people heading up to Boston for a meet. And the second bus, unfortunately, got a flat on the way home, so I got home at 4:30 in the morning.
Always an adventure when you're traveling via bus.
It is.
How hard is it with that many kids to keep a handle on things and to make sure everybody's getting what they need? Like, how big's your staff?
I have Chris Torello, who's an associate head coach. I have Dave Rick, who's in charge of sprints, hurdles, and horizontal jumps. And we have a graduate student, Gavin Campbell, who helps with recruiting and all of the pieces that he's permitted to help with recruiting. How hard is it? I guess there's a couple answers to that. It gets very busy. So you've got sprints, hurdles, and jumps doing a different practice than middle distance, who are doing a different practice than the long and middle distance long. And you've got recruiting going on. As long as you keep your eye on the ball, which is the student athletes, you can make all of that work. That's why we're full-time. We're not full-time just to write workouts and time kids. You don't need to be full-time for that. And I say two answers because I assume it could be challenging depending on the group you get. We either get lucky or the culture gets passed down, but we don't have a whole lot of – if we have problems academically, it's not I'm blowing off class, the heck with it. It's I'm having a challenge with class, I need help with it, kind of a deal. So do I have to follow up with kids who should have been in study hall? Yes. Or should have made their academic mentor meeting? Yeah. But people missing workouts for no reason. You know what the most common reason for missing workouts is? Class. They have a class that time and it conflicts. So the practice is some coaches meeting with kids at a different time for that reason. So the challenges are A, part of the job, and B, not negative type challenges, just challenges.
Track, cross country, these are kind of individual driven sports, but you're running a team.
Yep.
How do you balance that, or how do you mesh that? All these individual performances, but you still need everybody to feed into the concept of a team. Is that challenging in this? Because I think this is kind of a unique circumstance here. You know, football, basketball, everybody's got to work together in the moment, where a lot of this is people working on their own, but they're still part of the umbrella of your team.
Yeah. So to get a feel for any kind of a team culture, you have to treat it like a team. So every Wednesday, we have a 95-person meeting that goes for a half hour, 45 minutes. At the end of it, it's Coach Glavin's life lesson. That's either whatever made me happy or ticked me off during the week that they need to learn about. I always say to them, like, if nobody's ever told you this before, now you can't claim that no one's ever told you this. And we have that. But also, you don't try to meet that whole group every single day like that. So Dave Rick will take his sprints, hurdles, and jumps at the same time that I'll take distance and Chris will take middle distance. So from that point of view, not that challenging to do. From the point of view of make a team and individuals, even when we recruit, I tell them I don't believe that track is an individual sport. I believe it's a team sport, or we shouldn't be doing this representing the university as the track team. The nice part about it is you can coach them individually, bring them along at their own pace individually, and sometimes at individual times for class conflicts, and yet then assemble them as a team when the points are contributed. So the weird part is, like you mentioned, like basketball, for example. Everybody's on the court at the same time. If you contribute points, it's right then, and it's the team points. Whereas I can have a jumper over here and at the same time a sprinter over there, and they're both connecting to points independent of each other and then bringing them back to the team thing. So is it individual? Sure. And Matt, one of the really nice things about the sport is you can have a not so great team day and yet have some really fantastic things that happened. That's a little more difficult in the one team, one game, all or nothing thing, right? I can have a young lady run this weekend. We had a young lady test cross and she shattered the school record in the 800. So it wasn't even a scoring meet we went to. It was an invitational meet where you just went up to get the best competition in Boston. And so everybody didn't have the great day. It's a hell of a bus ride home when you're the one who had the bad day and she's sitting beside you. But she took 3 seconds off of the school record in the 800 meter. That's just not heard of, you know? So there can be these great things that happen in our sport, even if the whole team thing didn't happen quite the way we wanted it. So I kind of like that in that I'm guaranteed some ups and downs every single weekend.
As director of the whole thing, how much are you actually coaching? Like, if you had to kind of break down your day roughly percentage, how much of it is coaching and how much of it is paperwork, organizational, bureaucratic, and such?
Probably, I'm there about 55 hours a week, sometimes 60. 2 hours a day coaching. Although I come in on Sundays for the distance runners to go long. And then on Mondays, the distance runners aren't in. So I'll go down and watch Dave Rick and what his athletes are doing down at the track. So I would say probably maybe 15 hours a week is hands-on coaching. If I have an extra workout because somebody wasn't able to make it, you can add that a bit. So you take 55 minus 16 and you got 40 hours a week is the other stuff. Because you're going to have kids in, whether it's they have a problem because I have a problem with them, or they have a problem and so I'm trying to work with them, or we're having coaches meetings or team meetings and all that. Maximum 20 hours a week is doing the coaching, and the other 35 is doing the stuff that you need to do to make sure the program keeps running. And one of the things I'm learning only in my third year is the most important thing I still need to learn. So I'm 104 years old, right? And I'm still trying to learn. And that is, one of the biggest things for me is I need to stay out of the way of my assistant coaches. If I hired the right people, which I really feel like I did, then I don't need to be there overseeing that workout or asking them what they're doing. I go down actually to watch the kids because on Mondays my distance runners aren't in, so I get a little bored. So I go down to watch them and try to learn from what he's got them doing. So in case he ever leaves me, I have that to work on as well, or work with as well. So for me, the biggest part of my active coaching day is making sure I stay out of the way of my really knowledgeable coaches.
At this point, when athletes are to the point where they are Division I competitors, they are high level, right, how much are you coaching physical, starts, gait, whatever, and how much of it is neck up where you're dealing with emotional intelligence and confidence and stuff like that?
Probably should be 100% of each. All right, because they're not independent. It's not if you do 60% physical, then it's 40% mental, emotional, whatever. You got to look at all those. Am I perfect at getting to all those? Probably not. But you need to spend your time for every athlete as you watch them doing workouts. You know, for me with the distance runners, it's going around and around. For other people, it's an explosive this or... But you need to be watching all of the technique stuff, all of the physical aspects of it, because that's the area where you can kind of perfect the person in the area where it's easiest, I hate to say it, to perfect them. And then you get into the mental and emotional. And actually, with Division One, it might seem like by then they're already, one, we're mid-major Division One, but two, the levels of expectation go up. And therefore, and I'll call them kids again, but kids today take a little more pressure on themselves than they might have when I was in college. I went to St. Joe's. But they take some pressure on themselves that sometimes what you need to do is kind of let the air out of the balloon a little bit for them and say, you know, my favorite expression, so it drives them nuts, is when did you take the fun out of this sport? Like, you're making it so much of an, oh my God, if I don't. If you don't, then tomorrow morning the sun's going to rise. So if you remember to keep some fun in your sport, you'll relax a little bit more and go after that stuff.
So you mentioned you went to St. Joe's. Was track always your thing growing up? Like, was this the sport you gravitated to, or was this one of many that you played?
I played at 5'7" and 110 pounds. I went out for the freshman football team. And it will stun no one who hears this except that they can't stop laughing that I didn't make the team. I could actually catch. I just didn't realize that when you're on a freshman football team, usually your wide receivers are used to block, not to catch. So that was out. And then I went out for basketball. And sure, I'll lie to you and tell you I was the last guy cut before they finalized the freshman team, but it would be a lie. So I gravitated then to track. My father had run track in college and in high school, although he was a sprinter and gave me none of those genetics. I was a distance runner. And so I gravitated then to track to give it a try because I was going to do something athletic. And I found that especially distance running, but in track and field, the more you put into it, the more dedicated you are to it, the more passionate you are and the more aggressive you are as an athlete, the more you will get out of it. It's a guarantee that you probably could look at me and know that I was never going to play D1 basketball. But I kind of willed myself into being a D1 track guy. And I'm a firm believer in the fact that one of the great things of our sport is that there's another kind of talent that surfaces a lot in athletics. I used to believe talent was that physical thing. Give me a gal who has run 450 in the mile in high school. She's got talent. She's going to go somewhere. And sometimes they go nowhere because there's another talent, dedication and passion. There's another talent, like real, real aggressive, I want this and nothing's getting in my way attitude. And the coach frustrators are actually the ones with the physical talent who don't have those other things or don't care enough to bring those other things to the table. So was I always a runner? Probably in the back of my mind I was. And it got me places. The guy that brought me over to St. Joe's, Kevin Quinn, who is still a mentor of mine, he brought me over to run there. Then he brought me over to coach there. Then he handed it over to me, and then he retired once he felt that I was. And so Kevin is now retired from it.
And an alumni of this podcast, by the way.
Is he really?
He is.
Oh, there you go. Hi, Kevin. But, you know, there were so many things you could pick up from a man who understood the sport was more than running fast, that the sport was a way for people to learn character, to learn habits that you can take with you for life. Because quite honestly, like I told you, I'm 104. That's what I tell the kids. I'm 68, but my knees don't run anymore. My ankles don't run anymore. But there are things I took from what Kevin Quinn taught me as a mentor when he was my coach, and then taught me as a mentor when we coached together, that there's just no way I could ever have gotten those without being part of sport. Like when parents look at sport as athletics in a way possibly to get scholarship in college, I'm all for that. But you're missing the biggest point. And that is, it's a way for, like what I try to sell when parents and kids are in over the summer to talk about coming to St. Joe's is growth. I'm looking for academic growth. I'm looking for athletic growth. I'm looking for growth out of you as a person. If we can't, like if that, I'm okay if that doesn't sound good to you. There are 8 million other schools to go to. But understand there are going to be expectations of growth in all those areas when you come there.
When you're a young athlete, when did you learn that it was more than just running fast or running for a long time? Like, I think at that young age, it's just, all right, I'm just trying to get the fastest time. And maybe you don't realize everything that goes into
that. Never did as an athlete. I understood by the time I was done college that I really respected Kevin Quinn and that there were things he had taught me. But really it was, did you make the NCAAs? How did you do in the conference championships? And that's what the young athlete is supposed to focus on. And then you as a coach can redirect them and say, and here's a way to get that. And I'm still going to make you listen to my life lessons at the end of every Wednesday meeting. So you might as well absorb those. And the greatest thing in the world is, not that I would ever do this, but if I had a beer with a former athlete some night, you know, when they were back, to have them say, I remember when you said, or I'm coaching now and I tell my kids, and you realize that you hit the mark. So did I really realize in college it was more than all about that? Probably not. I was the athlete trying to grab everything I could out of the physical aspects that I did have. And when I first got into coaching, I'll admit that for some coaches, if not many, it might start with an I, like an ego thing. I can get these kids to that. I can coach that. Somewhere along the line, and there was no aha moment, the best thing that ever happened to me is when you start realizing that it's not about yourself, that it's entirely about, you know, at one point on the men's program, when I was just the men's coach, I had 72 guys on the St. Joe's men's team. Now with the whole thing going on with the house settlement and all that, it'll all go away with those. But with 72 kids, you better realize it's about those 72 kids, or why did you let 30 of them on the program? So to me, the biggest change for me, and you got to keep changing and learning, the biggest change for me, not in terms of learning workouts that keep evolving, but in terms of learning how to be a coach, was to come to 100% guarantee that this really has nothing to do with me, except, like, I like the idea of, for 2 years I'm telling you what to do, and then for 2 years you and I are discussing what works best for you. And then I know I've hit the mark, because now you've got something to do with your development, not just me.
What was your best event as a runner?
I liked the 5K and track. Cross country liked me better.
Okay.
So when I went to the NCAAs, it was twice in cross country. I did not make the NCAAs in track. I missed by 3 or 4 seconds or something like that. So longer was better. That's the key.
What type of mindset do you have to succeed doing that distance running? You have to have a certain mindset, because the whole idea is almost pain, running several miles consistently in any kind of heat, rain, whatever. So talk about the mindset you had to have as a young athlete to succeed at distance running.
Okay. One of those is back to that passionate dedication thing you're talking about. Because when it is pouring rain and it's 48 degrees, if today is 15 miles, today is 15 miles. And there's not, except for ice or lightning, there's no reason to cancel that. So part of it is that dedication. I think the mindset that best helped me, and it drives me crazy trying to get it over to all the athletes that you try to coach, was the idea that isn't pain, it's discomfort. There's a huge difference. Pain is when you break your leg. That's pain. What you're doing when you push in a race and go faster and faster, let's say two people, same talent, same training, who's going to win? What you're doing is finding out who will push to the edge, keep pushing, and find out if that is the edge. And so people who say, well, that hurts, my answer is always the same thing, and it's a coach's cliche, it's supposed to hurt. Because it's not really hurt. It's not pain. It's discomfort. And distance running especially is very, very uncomfortable. You know, when you're out on a cross-country course for 8,000 meters for 5 miles, and you're trying to run 4 minutes and 40 seconds a mile for all five of them, and by the way, that'll get your butt kicked at the NCAA level, you're going to be uncomfortable 2 miles in. So you either back off, look for a rhythm, and say, geez, not today, or you just keep pushing and hope that there's enough in the tank and the training and the body and the will to keep going. And some people get it and some people don't.
As a competitor, how often would you come across days where there wasn't anything in the tank? For whatever reason that day, you just hit a certain point and you're like, it's not happening today. Would that happen often?
It doesn't happen often if you prepare correctly and if your coaching is good, that it's got you tapering down towards it. I remember a workout day, not a racing day, when I was down on the track. We had qualified, I think I had qualified for the IC4As, which is a big Northeast meet. So I was down there kind of alone doing a training, and I forget what the workout was. I think it was 600s, because I always hated 600s. And I did the first one, and I didn't hit the mark. And Kevin was like, we good? I said, yeah, I'll take whatever recovery he says. I do another one. And he just said, look, why don't you go out and run 5 or 6 miles? This isn't working today. So sometimes in training, you have to realize that I don't know what was wrong, but there was no sense beating on that horse for 10 more of those. It just wasn't getting there. In a race, it's a little different because there are times when you just get to a certain point and the race is literally getting away from you and there's nothing you can do to stop that separation. Is it all the time? I think if you're properly seated, so you're in a race you belong in, not too frequently, but when you're trying to reach another level, so now we're in a race where that's a little bit above my head, you may fail three times before you succeed and say, oh, so when that felt like that, I was supposed to actually go in, even though it looked like blackness to me and I didn't have any clue as to where I was going to finish, I was supposed to actually step into that. Yeah. And then you find out by doing it once successfully and going, okay, got it.
Favorite part of a distance run? Is it early when you set your pace? Is it hitting your rhythm? Is it the close when you realize what you're capable of and who you can pass and stuff like that?
You're talking about a race,
a
right?
race, yeah. You racing. Okay. Like, what would you say is your favorite part?
For me, not as an athlete, because that was 104 years ago, right? But for me as a coach, I think two-thirds of your race earns you the right to be there. And the last third, you use the word closing, which is the word we always use. It's one coach, I think it was my buddy Frankie out in Oregon. He's a coach in high school. And he said, David Frank is his name. And he said, I use ABC, always be closing. So in other words, be in the race and doing that first two-thirds to be there. But understand that all of this is to earn the right to close this race. And you'd be surprised when somebody gets two-thirds of the way through or three-quarters of the way through. The watch goes out the window. The pacing goes out the window. I've spent too much time already in this race letting this guy do this to me. Now we go. And people will run these incredible closings, not just because they're coached with certain workouts, but because the race has that much value to them.
When did you realize in your life that track cross country was going to be a part of your life for the duration? Like, did you always figure you were going to coach and you were going to focus on these sports? Was your career as an athlete over and you were like, okay, what's next? Like, how did it all come together where this became kind of the guiding light of your life?
So sophomore year in high school, I decided I had a fantastic math teacher, Rosemary Holoka, rest in peace. But Rosemary I'm a mathematician, by the way. And she brought, people can make math really boring and hard. And she brought life and character and charisma into the math class. And I thought, bingo, I want to be able to do that. So I knew I wanted to teach. And I went to college with the idea of getting a bachelor's in mathematics and getting my degree in secondary ed as well, and did that. When I got out of St. Joe's, I had every intention of pursuing my running career while teaching. And my second year out, the track coach injured his knee. He was out. They came and asked me if I would. I was like, not what I had in mind, but sure. Well, you didn't have to be there for 1 month being in charge of the whole thing and realizing you can make a change. And so at Paul VI High School, they made me the boys' head track coach. And that was the end of my serious racing career because that's what I wanted to do.
We need to take a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Mike Glavin in just a couple of moments. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. Discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda, KBB.com's best value brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with Mike Glavin, the Director of Men's and Women's Cross Country and Track and Field at St. Joseph's University.
Did you know what you didn't know when it came to coaching when you started?
Oh, no, I made stuff up. That they didn't even have books out that said, like the terminology now for distance runners about threshold work and tempo and VO2, none of that stuff was even in writing. We had certain workouts we did that I just invented because they worked for me in college, and I invented the high school version of that. And then later somebody gave it a name, and I didn't invent it, by the way. I mean, I made it up for my team. It had been done, but then exercise physiologists got a hold of it and said, this works on this system. It's called tempo running or VO, and threshold. So I didn't know a whole lot of stuff. Great coaches, especially in distance, but in track and field, they steal. We are thieves. If somebody has done something that really seems to work, then why would you have to invent something else that works as well when you have that? So all I kept doing was talking to Steve Shackley down in South Jersey and Bill Collins down in South Jersey and Nick Baker down in South Jersey. They were friends of mine coaching when I was in high school coaching, and just stealing that and talking to Kevin Quinn and saying, what about this? And he goes, well, be careful. They're in high school, you know. And so I didn't know anything as I look back on it, except that I love to run. And I wanted to teach them. The one thing I did know is that I wanted to teach high school distance runners how to run strongly over a period of time. People here were going for an 8 mile or a 10 mile run and they think out to jog we go. And that doesn't get you ready to then run 3 miles at 5 minutes a mile. So there has to be strength to the run you're doing. And a whole lot of people weren't doing that. There's an awful lot of mistake in that everything should be easy except some of it has to be harder. And that was the one thing I did know I wanted to teach. But the rest of it, I stole it, I made it up, and then I learned it along the way.
And you had extraordinary the success at Pole the Sixth. I think I'm looking 110-0 yeah. as far as a record.
Yeah.
That's absurd. Like, did you realize how crazy that was? Or was it just the logical conclusion of doing what you do and we have success and that's how it works?
No. Well, sometimes you can look at it. I mean, I was 25 and 32 then. You can look at it as a matter of fact. And that was probably still, at least in part of that, was the, I did that. And I didn't do that. There is no doubt in my mind that had the first group that got turned over to me for cross country not bought in, had they said, yeah, you go run 10 miles, I'm not sitting here today. I had this group of kids who were sophomores that I inherited in that first spring track season when the guy hurt himself. Then they gave me cross country in their junior year, and the Vince Toomey and the John Hageman and the Pete Elliott and George Melko, these guys, they were like, okay, we'll do this. I'm getting calls over this summer before I even coached them once in cross country, just from track. Coach, we're going for a run from so-and-so high school today. Can you make it? So I had kids that were being captains as rising juniors, and they bought in 100%, and that made the folks behind them buy in. And then traditions are hard to break. So once people started doing it, what was accepted at Paul the Sixth was that we run. We don't go have peach fights in the orchards in South Jersey. We don't, you know, go around the corner and play basketball while coach isn't looking. We run. And since we also had the result of, and we win, not infrequently, they came together. But if I didn't have buy-in from that first group, there was nothing going on there.
I think in addition to that record, you had 3 state championships at Paul the Sixth and a state championship in track as well.
Yep.
That sound right? Like, when you think overall to your time there, like, what are your favorite memories? Are they championships or are they moments within years, seasons, practices, conversations?
I don't have favorite moments. I do have favorite periods where I just felt like that particular group. Like that first time they won the state championship, 2 years before, a bunch of those kids, when they were sophomores, sat down at a camp that we used to go to, the one that St. Joe's ran, Kevin Quinn ran. And we used to go to, we sat on a grass hill having a meeting and talked about 2 years from then winning the state championship in cross country. And again, they bought in wholeheartedly, and little did we know, we also had 2 freshmen coming in who were monsters. And so to me, that whole period of from the day on the hill at camp, you know, in August, all the way through 2 years later, when I think that was the group that won the Meet of Champions, which is state parochial title, and then the next one, it was such an incredible ride. So much so that I had to call my buddy in Florida and say, I'm coming down the day after Christmas. I need a break. Like, it was a really intense 2 years. I know it was only high school, but to those kids, it's not only high school. I still get emails from some of those kids. Coach, just wanted to let you know. And coach, this is me with the 2 babies and that kind of stuff that, you know, and we did it again when the Wolf from Sieslick, the Joseph, et cetera, era, when that group did it again 4 or 5 years later, it's the same thing. They even get together with each other via social media to argue who had the better team that year, their year or their year. And it's just, it's pretty cool that 50-something-year-old men are still arguing about my team was better than yours. And that's not what they're really arguing about. They're arguing about a body of memories that simply I got to play a piece of because I got to be the guy that kept kicking them into play and making sure they were doing the right stuff. How do you replace that?
So you're having this extraordinary success, obviously connecting with classes of kids. Was there a certain point where you thought, I'd like to try college, or does the opportunity at St. Joe's arrive, and given your relationship with Kevin, that you think, okay, I want to try this?
Yeah. So wasn't looking to try college. Kevin gives a buzz. Look, Mike Diorca, who was his assistant coach at the time, is heading down to build the Riley Center at Tulane University. He's out of here. I got a spot. I thought of you. And my answer was, I got a guy named Jason DeJoseph who may be the national champion. I got a team that could win all of this, including the Meet of Champions. I'm not. So he left this spot open for a year. So he must have heard, yeah, I'm willing to come, but I'm not walking out on these kids. And so I stayed one more year. But at some point I had to decide, you know, will I do this forever? And many coaches do. And then I thought, you know what, I'm going to give it a try. So I came over to St. Joe's. I want to say fall of 89 was it. But I stayed one year and he left the position open for a year. And then he was going to make me his assistant and everything. And he called me and said, look, I know if I make you my assistant for cross country, you're not coming over. I said, yeah, I'm not doing that. So you be the men's head coach and I'll be the women's head coach for cross. But I was his assistant coach indoor and outdoor.
What was different when you're coaching college as opposed to when you're coaching high school? Did it feel different? Did you have to use different tools out of the toolbox to have success, or did it translate for the most part?
No, well, I tried to make it translate. Geez, guys, and they were like, dude, that's just not working here. So I had to learn again, and you had to figure out, and you had to decide what kind of control you wanted that wasn't being so ridiculous that you were trying to control them like they were little kids. But at the same time, lucky for me, I had been a high enough level, I wasn't superstar, but I had been a high enough level as a runner in college to say, well, here's the deal, guys. Stop acting like you want to do this and then doing that stuff, because that is antagonistic to this. And so for the first bit, I got along very well with the guys, but there was a need to make it go the way I wanted. But they bought in. Again, I had enough buy-in that you have to bring an idea of what you expect to happen. My associate coach, Chris Torello, calls it the culture. And he goes, you have no idea. He came over from Monmouth and he just said, you have no idea the culture you have here and how that's so easy. And I said, well, it's not easy. I'm here for 35 freaking years now. It's not easy. But it had kind of come along to, again, it sounds matter of fact, but this is what we do. Like, you don't have to come to St. Joe's. But if you come to St. Joe's, this is what we do. So we do run. We do train. We do hold back on some of the things that the Animal House movie makes famous. We hold back on those things, especially when we're pursuing things in season, because you can't do both. You know, one is giving away to the other and vice versa. So I think there wasn't an automatic same culture as I have now when I got over, but I took some time to build that, and it's been worth all the time that was spent.
When you start college coaching, how difficult was recruiting? Do you feel like you've always been able to not just see the talent in kids, but project what was possible? Is that something you had to develop over time?
I still haven't developed it perfectly. So we had a guy, Benny Cook, years ago. Benny ran 4:32 and 2:02 in high school, and those are not good. And he asked if he could have a roster spot. And now, to be honest with you, with everything that's going on, I would have to say no. I'm down to 45. I used to have 72. Benny Cook was the Atlantic 10 Outdoor Track and Field Championship meet performer on the track, winning the steeplechase and the 5,000 in the exact same meet. And now I'd have to tell him no. Back then, I was just saying, sure, you can have a spot. But what kicked in was that other talent I talked about, his ability to be dedicated, passionate, and I tell kids you're born in a genetic box as far as athletics is concerned, and especially running. And that is, no matter what I do with you, there is, I don't know what it is, but there's a maximum. There's a fastest you can run the mile. There's a fastest you can run 10 miles. All of those are maximized. Our job is to find out, like, where are the confines of that box? And you can either quit and say, well, if I don't think I have much talent, or you can push your head against the top of the box, stomp your feet on the bottom of the box, push your elbows against the side, and find out how you can contort the box to allow you to maximize everything you want. That's somebody who's passionate about the sport. So did I know how to recruit back then? Yeah, you called a kid and said, hi, my name is Mike Glavin. I'm the coach at St. Joe's. Have I gotten any better at picking out the perfect talent? No, because there are kids at very sophisticated programs who you would think, yeah, they're already doing more distance. Their coaching is knowledgeable. They this. Maybe I want them, but maybe they're maxed. And you've got another kid who's got no rigor at all, and he's running the same time. Maybe I want him because there's so much untapped talent. Or maybe he's got no ability to put in the dedication. Maybe the only reason he's doing what he's doing is because they let him do whatever he wants. I don't know how you guess that. And when I figure it out, I'm writing a book, selling it, and probably retiring if enough people buy it. So I think the recruiting there, and Chris Torello helps an enormous amount with the recruiting, but the recruiting is one of, I like to sit and talk to the kid, put my spiel out there, let him meet people on the team for the next 36 hours, ask the team what they think, and then say, I got to feel I'd like to work with that kid. He's good enough. I'd like to work with him. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But if you know you have an affinity towards the athlete as well already, then whether she's a pure star or just somebody with enough talent, you think you get 4 years to do as much developing as you can together. And we've got Ava Curry right now. Ava ran about 5:15 in high school, which is not bad, but Alabama wasn't coming after her. Ava has run 4:49. She's run 40 seconds faster for 3,000 meters than she ran in high school. How would you know that, except that she bought in completely when Chris and I took over 2 years ago and said, okay, I'm in. And she's helping us bring a whole lot of people along with her that are in. So,
is teaching distance or coaching distance and coaching sprints, are they completely two different worlds?
Yes.
Or is there a lot of overlap?
Sprinters are a lot more like your game sport athletes. They need more power, more explosion, more rest, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to work on different aspects of their training because it doesn't matter how fast a sprinter can go around the track four times. I don't care. Get down the straightaway once, and how fast can you do that? And so there's all sorts of stuff you do towards those events. And the distance events have a lot to do with first your aerobic capacity, then your threshold, that is where you start building lactic acid, and then your speed towards your race and beyond the race, and you've got all those. So physically speaking, there's a world of difference in terms of that. And the middle distance runners, the 800 runners, fall somewhere in between. As far as getting them once they're all in, then it's just get me to the meet and get out of my way. And that's kind of the same for all of them because they're all trying to do the same thing. It's very different, Matt, from most other sports. I would say it's probably true, and I don't know, I'm not a basketball coach, that if my best player goes out every single game and tries to score more points than the time before, he's probably at some point going to hurt the team because he's not on that night, and he becomes kind of a ball hog. That's my guess. In track and field, the best contribution you can make to the team is running faster than you ever have in your life. And one of the reasons that distance runners and sprinters kind of have a different level of anxiety is because that number is like tattooed right there. If I'm a quarter mile and I've run 47.92, it's there because people know it. It's online. And when I go out there, I'm trying to do something with my body, literally, that it has never done before. When I try to run 47.80 or 47.30, I'm trying to do something and I've never been there before. And that can create a little pressure.
You've had so much success and the impact you've made, obviously, on the student athletes who have come through, just in the stories you've told and this whole conversation. Are there a couple of like concrete championships, wins, performances that you are most proud of that from your time at St. Joe's?
I'm twisting the question so my answer fits it a little bit. And I'm also going backwards because you said, were there moments? And I said, not individual moments when I was coaching in high school. But, and I'll take that back in one way. Because of those three state championships, there are memories that guys have that no one can ever take away. Because of the five, we've had five, I think, Atlantic 10 cross-country championships. Because of those five championships, those are memories that can never be taken away. Like the Atlantic 10 has a board that they put, electronic board, and you can go down it. And you can see five different times that St. Joe's on the men's side has won the Atlantic 10. And I think two or three on the women's side. I didn't do those yet. But those memories are like the one I liked the most was the first one we won at St. Joe's because I had been told that, and they have to do this, but the administration had met and I was still teaching and then coming over to coach, and that the goal for all sports, except obviously not basketball, they have a whole different set of pressures, but the goal for most of our sports was to be competitive in the middle of the Atlantic 10. And my answer was to the person who told me, like, well, I wasn't in on the meeting. Well, that's what our goal is. I said, well, my goal is to win the Atlantic 10. Well, you have to understand you've got large land-grant universities like, you know, blah, blah, and blah, blah, and all that. And it's going to be difficult and blah, 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 blah. So the next year we went out and won the Atlantic 10 meet. And it's kind of odd because then the woman's coach of cross-country, Kevin Quinn, my mentor, then went out the next year and won the women's Atlantic 10. And I was almost like, well, then couldn't that have always been done? Like, and it's not easy. I mean, we haven't won it since 2015. But the idea that someone else outside of the sport is going to set the goals. You can set the goals in some ways because you're in charge of the whole thing. But you can't tell me to lose, right? So and you can't tell the kids not to rise up to the level they did. So
that had to be incredibly satisfying, that first one.
It really was. And in fact, most of the coaches at St. Joe's outside of basketball at that time were part-time. We were all part-time. The only reason Kevin Quinn was full-time is because he was also the director of all facilities and athletics. So he was still part-time as a coach. And so I walk in the Monday after, and Tom Turner, again, rest his soul, who was the soccer coach, is outside. And I can't tell why. And he walks over to me, and he puts his hand out because we had won it on Saturday. And I didn't see them on Sunday. And he shakes my hand, and he starts to squeeze it. He said, "You jackass. Now they know it can be done with part-time coaches." And I was in hysterics, and he said, "Congratulations," and he gave me a hug. But it was like, now do you understand? Later, I saw the coach from UMass, Kenny O'Brien, who had been there for as many years as Kevin, like 38, 40 years. And Ken said, "Do you understand what I have to do now?" I said, "I don't." He goes, "I have to go back and explain to my administration how a part-time coach who's teaching high school most of the time just won the Atlantic 10 over a full-time coach for Andy." So he has to now justify his position. And he wasn't serious. It was a funny way of saying congratulations. But it's certainly tougher when you're driving over the bridge at 3:45 in the afternoon to get the stuff done. But yes, it was very satisfying.
Was there a conscious decision? Because, you know, like you said, 36 years at St. Joe's. Was there a conscious decision that this is where I'm going to set up my shingle and this is going to be home for the duration? Like, or was it one of those where you kind of 10 years in, "Oh, wow, I've been here a decade. That's crazy. 20 years." Mm-hmm. And then it's just, okay, this is what I want to do. I don't mean to put that like it's settling, but yeah. It's just life, yeah. Kind of. Like, was it a conscious decision that I don't really want to go anywhere else? This is where I went to school. I'm comfortable. I'm having success. I can get it done. You know, or you know, was there a certain moment where you kind of had to talk to yourself about that?
Don't remember the moment, but I can tell you, yes, there was a conscious decision, because when I first came over and we started having success in cross country, not that that's like, that isn't, it's not football, basketball, cross country in that order in the United States, right? But when we started having success, I thought, you know, this could take me to place A, B, or C, and what I then might have considered moving up. And then I was there for a while, and I remember getting to the point where I thought, and I wasn't married yet. Julie and I married later, but I remember thinking, you know what? You don't have to move on and move what you consider to be up in terms of the fame of a program or in order to be really, really useful, worthwhile, and productive. And that was so, it was probably within 10 years, you mentioned. It was probably somewhere around 10 years. So I was only about 42. But I thought, I like what I'm doing here. And I started to know, I was talking to a recruit yesterday about St. Joe's isn't famous for being hard to get into. St. Joe's, for guidance counselors who know St. Joe's, is famous for being very challenging to get out of. And that's a very important difference for me, because what I'm selling is not the name of a famous university. What I'm selling is the productivity and growth for a young man or young woman that has them on the way out with the kind of reputation on their degree that's going to get them jobs in the business world, in the applied health science field. And so I started getting a feel for what it was I was doing, and it wasn't just coaching. It was listening to what St. Joe's was doing as it evolved, and then saying, look, here's what we can do, but you need to, like I asked the girl yesterday, I said, she had told me she works very hard for the grades she gets and the whole deal. I said, bingo, love you. I love you, because there are plenty of people who have really high grades in high school, and they don't work hard, and they go to college, and we all know of some of them, right? And they tank in college because they have no work ethic when it comes to academics. This girl works hard for what she gets. So this is not going to be tough when I say you're going to need to put in a few more hours, as opposed to the guy or gal who never put in a few hours, let alone a few more. So I got to the point where I realized I wasn't coaching at St. Joe's. I was part of St. Joe's. I was part of its athletics. I was part of its admissions, because you bring in kids. I can't bring in as many now, but you bring in kids, and that helps admissions. And I was part of learning what St. Joe's was trying to be about and selling that on the way in. So I didn't bring in people who just thought they were like God's gift to the athletic world, because nobody's putting that much pressure on us to win in track or cross country. So you better do something else. And it's the student athlete experience is the something else.
Do you have a favorite part of competition day, whether it's A-10 championships or invitation, whatever? Yeah. But do you have a favorite part? Is it the anticipation? Is it the moment before a certain event? Is it downtime in between events? Like, do you have a favorite part?
If I do, I've never thought about it. If I do, it's when the meet starts. I don't like the anticipation. Because I'll tell the kids, I said, you know, when I used to be a runner, I had to get up for one race, maybe 14 minutes, 14, 15, whatever it was, for 5,000 meters, maybe 25 minutes in cross country. I had to worry about me being ready, being properly fed and hydrated, and I had to worry about me getting cooled down afterwards. Now, there could be, between men's and women's, 25 events going on, and as the director, I'm in some way a piece of everything that's going on, so it's exhausting. But once the meet gets started, you're no longer worried about this or worried about that. The kids know what's expected of them in terms of warm-up and how to get ready, and then you just start watching what they do and being disappointed for, not in, but for the kids who don't have a good day, and being so excited for the kids who, you know, there's nothing uglier and better than that sweaty hug you get, right? It's disgusting. My shirt is now disgusting, but because she just ran the third fastest time in St. Joe's history for that, or she just jumped the fifth fastest distance. And so I guess those individual parts, when they happen, where there's something elite that happens, but in general, when the meet starts, I like it because now we can just start doing this.
Mike Glavin, this was great. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me. Appreciate you, Matt.
And that will do it for this episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Mike Glavin, director of men's and women's cross country and track and field at St. Joseph's University, for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me there as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.